Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is a special live episode of Dispatches. Well into the sixth month of Israel's Holocaust in Gaza, the situation continues to worsen. Over 30,000 killed that we know of, with estimates of a looming intentional famine that will wipe out tens of thousands more if Israel has its way. Israel continues to lie, smear its victims, and get away with it in the Western press. The Biden administration continues to support every genocidal Israeli ambition, regardless of how it impacts his re-election prospects. Palestinians continue to resist and fight for survival with the support of regional forces aligned against imperialism, but of course still having to deal with traitors in their midst. And while people around the world are repelled by Israel's behavior, a sense of hopelessness and helplessness is beginning to kick in. Joining me to discuss these developments is Ali Abunima, Executive Director of the Electronic Intifada and author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Ali, welcome back to Dispatches.
Thank you, Rania.
It's so great to have you back on, though, once again, to talk about some really horrendous stuff. And, you know, the last time I had you on, I think, was just a few weeks into this genocide. So a lot has happened since then, but also a lot has remained the same. And there's so many different angles of this I want to touch with you. I think the first place I want to start is on the issue of propaganda. And the reason I want to start there, Ali, is because the Electronic Intifada has been at the forefront of exposing the worst of Israel's propaganda, the most effective, unfortunately, of Israel's propaganda, that being around issues like Israel's claims that that Hamas carried out acts of mass sexual violence on October 7th, which were used by the entire Western mainstream media apparatus, propagated by them without any evidence, to essentially justify genocide. There's also the fact that Israel killed so many of its own citizens on October 7th in its attempt to suppress the Palestinian armed resistance from taking Israelis hostage and then exchange for Palestinians. They were using the Hannibal Directive, and the Electronic Intifada, again, has been at the forefront of exposing much of that. There was a scandal around the 40 beheaded babies that never were, and on and on and on. I could sit here, you know, for a while and just go on with all the various Israeli lies that have been disproven. But I think what's really important is that the Electronic Intifada's reporting on a lot of this has actually burst into the mainstream in some ways. So I want to start there. You know, what are your thoughts on all of this propaganda, on the Electronic Intifada's ability to poke so many holes in it that now you have bigger outlets reporting it? And on the fact that there is a very real Israeli pattern of committing a huge atrocity and then deflecting blame for that atrocity. Right here, I'm talking about, you know, with hospital bombings and massacres, with killing people waiting for aid and bread lines. I know I just threw a bunch of things at you, but please take it from where you want. But I just want to really commend you for the excellent and brave reporting that you and your colleagues have been doing, because it's been so, so important in pushing back against these lies.
Thank you, Rania. And I'm also very proud of my colleagues. The work that we did, I mean, the Electronic Intifada, you're right, we've been on the forefront of some of these stories. We haven't been alone, and I think that's important to say. There have been a handful of independent media outlets and independent journalists and investigators who have really been dogged in pursuing these stories. That includes Mondo Weiss, The Gray Zone, and lately, The Intercept, who came on very late. But again, that's important. Better late than never, right? We would prefer that than that they stick to, as The Intercept had been doing previously, promoting some of the Israeli propaganda. We always like it when people see the light. So I think one of the stories that the Electronic Intifada really did lead on was the friendly fire, the fact that Israel killed significant numbers of its own people on October 7th. It's difficult to say how many, whether it's a majority or something less than that, I think it could, it's conceivable that it could be a very large number. And we led on that back in October when we published the testimony of Yasmin Porat, an Israeli woman who survived the violence in Kibbutz Be'eri, one of the colonial settlements near Gaza. And she, in an interview with Kan, the Israeli state broadcaster, very early on stated very clearly that many Israeli citizens at Kibbutz Be'eri, in the house where she was being held, were killed by Israeli fire. It turned out Israeli tank fire. That was corroborated by another survivor. There were only two Israelis who survived that massacre. And also by video, which actually showed one of the tanks firing in Kibbutz Be'eri later on. I think what's important to say is what we did, and it's not easy, but it's not very complicated either, is that we were mostly taking information from Israeli sources and Israeli media. So, for example, the interview with Yasmin Porat, our colleague David Sheen, translated it very meticulously. We subtitled it, and then we wrote a story about it, with providing a lot of context and other information and so on. I can tell you that's hard work. We sometimes run very long hours doing it, but it's not work that the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN couldn't do if they wanted to. In fact, they could probably do it better than us because they have far greater resources than we do, but they choose not to. And that really is the significant part of this, that there has been no coverage of the friendly fire in U.S. Western media. And, of course, they all know it's happening because they read the same Israeli press we do. They monitor it closely. And so there's a decision to keep this information from the public, whether it's in the United States or Europe or elsewhere, in order to sustain this narrative that Hamas killed all these people on October 7th. So I think that's one of the observations. What we do has become, I think, crucial, but we would welcome it if CNN and the New York Times, etc., did it, but they choose not to.
No, I mean, even worse, the New York Times led repeatedly this smear, this racist smear. And I mean, when we talk about sexual violence, I don't take that lightly. I don't think any of us.
Nor should we. We never should.
Of course not. But I find it incredibly offensive to use it to justify a genocide, one, even if sexual violence were to happen. Nothing justifies genocide. Moreover, I find it incredibly racist. I mean, this to me is tantamount to accusing a black man of raping a white woman to justify lynching him. Go ahead, please.
And that's exactly where it comes from. It's that same racist, old racist trope that was often used. I mean, if you go to the website of the Jim Crow Museum, they talk about the stereotype. They have a really good article on the stereotype of the black brute, the idea that black men were inherently violent, inherently, sexual predators, and that this was a central idea and justification used to justify lynchings and other organized white supremacist violence against black people. And this violence also, this trope also has a very old presence in the colonial context. It was also used against indigenous people in North America and throughout the colonial world. The idea that black and brown men, colonized men, are an inherent danger to white and settler women. So, and then you add to that the kind of modern day propaganda that has been so prevalent in the West in recent decades, demonizing Muslims as inherently violent, as rapists, as irrational, as wild beasts or human animals, as the Israeli government calls them. And these fears that have been instilled into Western publics and audiences. And then you add to that the sort of, so that's a very racist idea that we've just talked about. But then you add to that the sort of progressive or liberal sensibility about believe women and Me Too. And then it becomes potentially a very powerful narrative to accuse Palestinians or to accuse Hamas of this kind of sexual violence, with the sense that few or no people will push back, either because people will simply accept the claim on its face because of this racist conditioning, or they'll be reluctant to push back because they don't want to be accused of being, as we have been accused, rape apologists, or that we don't believe women, for example. And so it's a very powerful narrative in that sense, until, of course, you look at the facts and it all falls apart.
And I encourage people, I've seen you do meticulous takedowns on the Electronic Intifada live stream, going thoroughly through the New York Times's reporting and all of the holes on the mass rape story. And you've done it more than once. The Electronic Intifada website is full of articles debunking. I mean, it's just the work you've been doing on that is so incredible. The New York Times should be absolutely ashamed of itself for promoting this horrific, racist, genocidal smear against Palestinians. Meanwhile, there's another aspect to this, Ali, which is the fact that a group of experts, legal experts at the UN, actually came out and showed accusations. They laid out some evidence that, in fact, it's Israelis who've been carrying out sexual violence in what looks like a pretty systematic manner against Palestinian women and actually Palestinian men as well. There's been accusations from Palestinian women of being raped, of being stripped naked and left outside in cages in the cold. I mean, just the most disgusting, just saying that, just like, it's vile. It's completely depraved and vile. And I have not seen the New York Times or any other mainstream media outlet. I could be wrong. I have looked it up a few times. I have not seen that reported anywhere except for in the outlets that seem to view Palestinians as human being enough to have that be reported on. I've seen U.S. spokespeople repeatedly get on podiums and say that they'll let the Israelis investigate themselves for sexual violence. And then, you know, you've got this mentality about Palestinians, like the Israelis think they're so, the Israelis are so moral, they would never rape anyway. And I'm just curious your thoughts on that, given that there's an actual documented history since Israel's founding and perhaps before of sexual violence being a part of colonial violence throughout.
Yeah, the rapes of Palestinians by Israeli forces go back to 1948 at least, and there are well-documented cases, including open confessions in recent years by elderly veterans of the Haganah, the Israeli Zionist militia that ethnically cleansed and murdered Palestinians during the Nakba. And recently there have been these testimonies from Palestinian men and women, firsthand testimonies saying, I experienced this. This is what I went through about sexual violence and sexual humiliation. And the Israelis themselves have published proudly images and videos of them stripping Palestinian men, elderly men, and even sometimes what look like children, stripping them naked in these rituals of collective humiliation, effort to break them, which are a form of sexual violence as well. And this goes back to an idea that was expressed in a book called The Arab Mind by Rafael Patai, an Israeli a scholar of many decades ago, long since deceased. But that book became popular among American military and other officials at the time of the Iraq war, the U.S. aggression against Iraq more than two decades ago, and was the sort of one of the concepts behind the kind of brutal torture and sexual humiliation of Iraqis that we saw in places like Abu Ghraib. And it's this racist idea that Arab men have this particular pride and set of complexes around their manhood and sexuality. And so in order to break an Arab man, you have to humiliate him sexually. So these very racist ideas. And all of that is present now, and there's plenty of evidence of it in terms of direct testimonies from Palestinians and so on. And then you contrast that with the Israeli allegations of mass rape, where there is not a single victim who has been identified, not one who has been positively identified, living or dead, not one person, unlike in the case of Palestinian women and men who've come forward and said, this happened to me. There's not one case of an Israeli woman or man coming forward and saying, I personally experienced this kind of sexual violence or rape or humiliation. And I'm not saying they need to go on TV and give an interview. We wouldn't expect that of any person who has experienced this kind of sexual violence. But we're talking about how the Israeli police themselves very early on said they couldn't match victims to some of these atrocity claims about sexual violence, that nobody had come forward despite public appeals to say, you know, come forward confidentially. This bogus UN report that came out recently, we've also done segments about that on the Electronic Intifada live stream, and with my colleague Esau and Stanley, we wrote a long analysis of that report. So I can refer people to that if they're interested in that. But before Pramila Patten, the UN official, a political appointee who went over to Israel to investigate these claims, the UN also made public appeals and said to any victims, Israeli victims, come forward. You can speak to us confidentially. We will protect you. We want to listen to you. We want to make sure there's accountability for the perpetrators who did this to you. Not a single person came forward. The New York Times, infamous New York Times report done by Jeffrey Gettleman, Anat Schwartz, and Adam Sella at the end of December. Anat Schwartz, and this is one of the elements of that scandal around the New York Times fraudulent report alleging that there was lots of evidence for what they called this a broad pattern of sexual violence. Anat Schwartz revealed in a podcast to Israel's Channel 12 in Hebrew, and the Intercept, to their credit, found that and translated it and reported on it. She said that when they started this reporting, she's been attacked and accused, rightly, I think, for her, you know, right-wing and anti-Palestinian views, and also for not having any reportorial experience before doing this very sensitive assignment. But nonetheless, I have to give her credit. What she said in the Channel 12 podcast in Hebrew really showed some good basic reportorial initiative, in that the first thing they did is they contacted every rape crisis center in Israel, every hospital that had a special unit to treat victims of sexual crimes, they could not find a single report. Not a single one of these institutions had received a single report of sexual violence on October 7th. Not one. So at that point, the New York Times reporters and editors should have stopped and said, wait a minute, maybe the story here isn't of a broad pattern of systematic rape. Maybe the story here is about atrocity propaganda and a hoax. And that's what we should be looking at. But that's not what they did. Instead, they basically, it appears they said to themselves, well, there's no victims. There's no crime here that we can find. So we'll have to come up with victims in a crime. And that's what led them to this really fraudulent report that fell apart very quickly when we at the Electronic Intifada and others started to examine it line by line.
Yeah, I think there's going to be PhDs written about that, in my opinion. We'll see if that actually happens. But I really quickly just want to remind those who are watching to make sure you like the stream. It does help boost it in the algorithm. And also thank you to the person who donated. The name was Conetheus. I hope I'm saying that right. Appreciate that. So Ali, I want to ask you about some of the fascism that we're witnessing right now. Now, you have been covering Israel's descent into fascism for years. You're someone I've looked to understand Israel's descent into madness. And that's not to say Israel hasn't always had fascist elements to it. It's a settler colonial society that was founded on extreme violence and has maintained extreme violence. And Palestinians have lived under a kind of fascism always. Because they've lived under occupation, under land theft, under ethnic cleansing and genocide, essentially, all this time. However, Israeli society today is, I mean, maybe they've always been this way. I don't know, but we're seeing it. We're seeing them videotape themselves celebrating the shattering of children. Literally, they are telling us they want to tear Palestinian children limbs off of their bodies. They're celebrating starving babies. They are lining up at the border with Gaza to block food aid from going in. They're telling us they see Palestinians as basically insects, animals, vermin, whatever, all the genocidal language you can imagine. I'm shocked. I personally am shocked. Maybe I'm naive to be shocked, but to see these people, this brainwashed society revel in mass murder is so stunning to me. And so I guess my question for you, which I keep asking people this, my question for you is, are you surprised by this level of hate? Not by just, by the way, Israelis, but we see this among some people in the US as well who are celebrating Palestinians being murdered in mass.
Yeah, that's really a question I think about. And, you know, it's become a very common thing to say that Israel has its most right-wing government ever, its most openly fascist, whatever how you want to describe it. I think there's a general consensus that that's the case. But the risk when you say that is it erases the fact that Israel was founded from its first moment, from the moment the Zionist movement arrived from Europe into Palestine, on racist, fascist, colonial, white supremacist ideas that came directly from Europe. There were European ideas of colonialism, and before Zionism was a so-called Jewish movement, it was a Christian evangelical movement, much more so than a Jewish movement, because the vast majority of Jews in Europe opposed Zionism. That, you know, again, started to shift later. That's a good topic of discussion with Professor Joseph Meshed, who I know you've had on the show, and I hope you'll have again one day.
Foreshadowing.
So we don't want to erase that history. 1948, the Nakba was brutal violence, murders, massacres, rapes, destruction. And then every Israeli, you know, every year since then has been the same. Israel murders Palestinians. What Israel has done to Lebanon is no less barbaric and savage than what we're seeing now. So can we really say that Israel is more right-wing? I think that that is not a straightforward answer. But I think what we can say is that in the past, remember that Israel was founded and dominated for its first 30 years of its existence by, and before Israel was founded, the Zionist movement was dominated by the so-called labor Zionist trend, which portrayed itself as secular and socialist and progressive and was perceived as such in the West. You know, you had all these young people, like, for example, Josep Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, who went over there as an idealistic young Spanish socialist to work on a kibbutz. These were colonial settlements, like the ones around Gaza, built on land of ethnically cleansed Palestinians, and sometimes built as military garrisons, but still marketed as socialist collectivist farms. So I think that Israel, there was a sort of an unspoken agreement between Israel and its Western sponsors, is that you will pretend to be a progressive liberal democracy, and we will pretend to believe you. And that deal is now broken. Israel no longer feels the need to pretend and doesn't pretend. But there are still elements in the West who yearn for an Israel that pretends to be that. And so they still have this out of touch and outdated view of Israel as, oh, yes, well, yes, there are some bad people. The Netanyahu government is bad, but there is a real Israel there that still shares our wonderful liberal progressive values, and it just needs to have a chance to express itself. And we saw a lot of that delusional thinking when Naftali Bennett, another brutal, violent racist, briefly led the government of Israel in this sort of coalition that brought together, you know, various elements, but was just as brutal and violent. But it fulfilled the fantasy of European and American elites that there is this other Israel. And what Israel is telling us is there isn't. This is who we are. And as they say, when people tell you who they are, believe them. And we should believe the Israelis when they say that they are expressed in every possible way through government statements from the top government officials to the, you know, silly TikTok videos they made, that this is who we are. We are genocidal. We view the Palestinians as Amalek, and we want to murder them and destroy them. And we think it's funny and hilarious when we blow up mosques and universities. And we think it's great to make fun of people who we're deliberately starving. That's who they are. And there is no real alternative to that among the Israeli Jewish population. There's like a very, very tiny dissident left. But even some of the Israeli left, you know, those people who've marketed themselves as the Israeli left, I've seen in recent months, defending the atrocity propaganda about mass rapes when they have no excuse. They can read just as well as I can and see how these things have been debunked, but they insist on pressing these lies. So there is no left in Israel. There is no real anti-genocide constituency in Israel. And Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, a Democrat and a very prominent supporter of Israel in the United States, a few days ago made a speech with a big fanfare saying that, you know, Netanyahu has to go and that Israel should hold new elections, as if new elections would produce something other than a worse government. I mean, yeah. In Israeli terms, Netanyahu is something of a moderate. I mean, this is the shocking thing. As brutal, as bloodthirsty, as barbaric, as savage, as cruel as Netanyahu is, he's probably a centrist in Israeli terms now.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I can't even stand the people who then they like cover all of their ideas about, there are some pro-ceasefire people in the US or people who are like anti-Netanyahu, but it's all because of Israel's security. They're like, no, we need to maintain Israel as a Zionist Jewish ethno state. And the only way to do that is if somebody less vile, openly vile, is in power, but continues the same policies, essentially. It's always about Israel's security. It's never about, of course, I wouldn't expect it to be, but it's never about, you know, Palestinians. It's
security.
Never
Palestinians deserve security. Let's use the term Palestinian security. And I say that Palestinian security means that this brutal Zionist settler colony cannot continue to exist as it is, that there's no way for Palestinians to be secure with this brutal, barbaric, genocidal entity on their soil. So
that's Palestinian, by the way, that's, The region cannot be secure. I was going to say the entire region cannot be secure.
Correct. The entire region cannot be secure. Its people cannot be secure. So, but of course, they'll never allow that kind of discussion in any kind of mainstream forum in Israel. The Palestinians are at best victims of Israeli excesses. You can sympathize with them as victims. This is another idea that Joseph Massad, who I mentioned earlier, has written about in the past few months, that Western liberalism will allow you to sympathize with Palestinians as victims. Mm-hmm. That, oh, look at those poor people. They have human rights. We should respect their human rights. But you cannot empathize with them or support them or allow them to be agents as people who are fighting for resistance, as people who have the, you know, that terrible abused word agency to fight and liberate themselves. So at that point, they become terrorists. And you'll see that trend a lot in Western liberalism still, where, well, yes, we sympathize with Palestinians and Israel shouldn't do these things to them, but what Hamas did is terrible. And we don't support that violence. So you support the liberation of Palestine, but you don't support Palestinians actually liberating it. So how is it going to come about? Through the kind-heartedness of Israel? Well, clearly that's not going to happen. Through the good offices of the United States, which is airlifting bombs around the clock to Israel to murder Palestinians, that's not going to happen. To the Europeans who have all supported this and armed it, well, that's not going to happen. So how's it going to happen? I mean, it's only going to happen if people boycott, resist, make Israel pay a price. And there's still a reluctance to accept that if you hold all these things about Israel to be true and that you understand Palestinians and oppressed, colonized people and that their situation is only getting worse, it follows then that you cannot be sincere about that unless you support their right to resist, their right to pick up arms to fight this really unspeakable evil that has been visited on them for so many decades with the full backing of the so-called West, which comes to lecture people in the region about human rights and women's rights and apple pie and all that.
I mean, I'm sitting in Beirut right now. If I could throw a rock any which way, I'll hit like some NGO office that's working on women's empowerment or LGBTQ rights or helping the underprivileged, all funded by like the US, Canadian, German.
All funded by the bitterest enemies of the Lebanese people.
Yeah. And these are not going to liberate anybody. I mean, no, they're not going to liberate anybody in Palestine, that's for sure. And I think people, interestingly enough, I do see, at least online, and I'm not saying online is a barometer for how the general public sees things, but I do see more people than in the past being more openly supportive of armed Palestinian resistance, or at least impressed by it. And from that, I want to ask you an important question to me, and I think a lot of people maybe would benefit from hearing your thoughts on this. And that is, you know, and I've been asking other people this question too, because for many months, I feel like I was kind of pep talking people. I was like, no, like Israel can't win. Here's why. Like, it's horrible what's happening, but like the resistance is resisting, you know? Mm. But, you know, we're into the 6th month of this, Ali, and it's soul crushing to watch what's happening, right? Like there's an intentionally created famine used as a weapon. Mm. There's the hospitals have all been bombed. Israel is pushing Palestine. They've pushed so many Palestinians into the south, and now they're preparing an operation in the south. People are living in ways I can't even like fathom. And it's just it's a couple hundred miles away from me. Like, I mean, I get to get up every morning and drink coffee and eat food. And I have a heater on and I have electricity. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's Lebanon, so I mostly have electricity sometimes, but I have electricity. I can go to the gym. I can live my life. And there's people not that far from me who get up every day cold after having a cold night. hearing constant drones, hearing constant bombings, being terrified, and their day starts off with searching for food and water. Disease is spreading. There's no toilets. Like, and on top of that, there's just bombings everywhere. And this has been going on for 6 months. People have been losing their families. They've lost their children, their fathers, their mothers. I mean, you know all this. I'm just, for those who are watching, I'm just stating the level of horror that people in Gaza are facing. Is it's, you can't even describe it in words.
Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I know what you're getting at. I mean, you need a pep talk now, right?
I'm asking for a pep talk because I think people are getting helpless and hopeless. And they also see, especially in Global North countries, that their governments are not reflecting any of their opinions, no matter what they do. It's like these massive protests are taking place. And their governments aren't changing their opinions. In some cases, yeah, like these, some European governments, the Canadians, whatever, have, you know, had some, you know, soft words about a ceasefire. But for the most part, you know, the US government, I guess, is the most important here. It's like nothing, people feel like nothing they do matters. And they're just watching people be massacred. And so, yes, we need the pep talk, Ali. Like, why can't Israel, because Israel, I still believe Israel can't win. In the long run. But, and I think, you know, obviously liberation means a lot of sacrifice. And I mean, you look at any liberation struggle in history, but at the same time, what do you have to say to those who feel helpless and hopeless?
Well, I don't want to offer false hope, but I want to offer what I think is a realistic assessment, which includes some reasons for hope. And the first thing to say is that the situation, just to affirm that the situation for Palestinians in Gaza is beyond any description. And this is what they tell us. I'm in touch with a lot of our colleagues, a lot of our writers for the Electronic Intifada in Gaza every day. And I don't know how they who have already been through so much in Gaza through repeated Israeli massacres and years of siege say, we never thought things could get to where they are, and we never thought we would see the horrors we would see. And the starvation now, the deliberate starvation, is something that is just unbearable. People, I saw, you know, there was a text message I got today, someone talking about, we finished the animal fodder that we were eating. We've eaten the bird seed, the chicken feed we had. We now go out looking for weeds and grass to eat, and we tell ourselves it's we lie to ourselves that it's delicious. And it's just, you know, people say that they wake up in the morning and the first thing they do is drink as much water as they can, assuming they can get clean water, and sometimes people can't, but they fill their stomachs with as much water as they can to try to temporarily quiet the hunger pangs. And this is something that, you know, imagine that you could somehow endure it. Could you watch your elderly mother or father endure it? Could you watch your children endure it? And this is what people tell us, is that, you know, I'm ready to, you know, to take whatever, but I can't watch my parents going through this. I mean, I'm just trying to reflect, and I'm doing a poor job reflecting the Holocaust that people are being put through. But let's now step back and look at the big picture here. Yes, this has been going on now for almost 6 months. We will be at 6 months soon. But did Israel and the United States expect that this would be happening after 6 months? Why is Israel starving people? Yes, they announced that they would starve people from the beginning. They said, we're cutting off everything to the human animals in Gaza. But now they're doubling down on starvation as a weapon, because the Israeli army has withdrawn from large parts of Gaza in defeat. And I think it's fair to say that, militarily speaking, they haven't achieved a single one of their stated goals. Hamas and the other resistance factions are still fighting. Anywhere where there are Israelis, Hamas will attack them. The resistance will attack them. And we know it because they'll put the videos out showing exactly what they did. In the north, the areas which Israel claimed to have conquered in the first weeks and destroyed the resistance there, the resistance is still fighting. Israel even massacred people the other day in the north who were queuing for flour, I think because Israel was upset to see organized distribution of aid by local officials and with the cooperation of people. And Israel interpreted that as a return of civil government and order, which Israel doesn't want. So they started massacring people. So Israel has achieved nothing militarily. And it has been unable to impose its will on the resistance. The resistance is, of course, not indifferent to people's suffering. In fact, they are extremely concerned about it. And they say in all their statements that our first priority is to end the war of extermination, the genocide against our people. But what they will not agree to is, you know, we had it in November, the so-called temporary pause or truce, and the exchange of prisoners at that time. But they say, well, what's the point of repeating that if Israel is simply going to return, as it did after the truce in November, to even more savagery and brutality and massacres? So we want the war to stop completely, which is a very reasonable demand. And by the way, you never see the fighters saying, oh, we don't want to fight the Israeli army. On the contrary, they say, send your soldiers here, we'll take care of them. But they're saying, don't kill our wives, our mothers, our children, our fathers, our uncles. Why are you killing them? If you want to fight us, come and fight us. You see in every resistance video, you see Israeli soldiers. And you don't see civilians in those areas. You just see Israeli soldiers and the Palestinian resistance fighters attacking them. And they're saying, we will confront you. You come here, we welcome you to come. Hezbollah says something similar. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in one of his recent speeches that if that army, that rabble army that's in Gaza that's unable to fight the resistance, that's your army, well, welcome to Lebanon. We'll take care of you here. But that's different from, you know, don't massacre our children. But that's what Israel does. They can't fight the resistance. They've been unable to defeat it militarily or politically. On the contrary, it's stronger than ever politically. So they resort to murdering civilians, destroying all the hospitals, destroying all the housing, and now starving people to death. That's not a war. No army fights like that. It's just genocide. And why is Israel doing it? Because they think that by starving people, by murdering people, they will break the resistance and they will turn the people against the resistance. And that has completely failed. It has completely failed. And it will continue to fail. If people have come this far and they are still holding on, as horrifying as it is, in conditions that are unbearable, Israel's not going to break them. It's not going to break them. And at the same time, I think Israel is so exposed as just a monstrous entity that there is no, yes, we still have our traitor class in the region who still wants to curry favor with the Americans and still even may want to normalize with Israel. But the idea that Israel will ever be accepted by the masses in the region just seems so remote to me. I mean, just this utter horror. I don't want to go on too long, but what's the other side of this is that why is Israel so brutal and so savage? And why is the West so determined to back Israel no matter how barbaric it is? It's because they see Israel's defeat. And I think it's important to say Israel was defeated on October 7th. Mm-hmm. The reason Israel is so eager to push these fake stories of atrocities, whether, you know, beheaded and burned children or the mass rapes, all these lies, is to distract from the reality that Israel, that Hamas and the resistance carried out a very well-planned, sophisticated, military assault on October 7th that decimated and destroyed the Israeli army in the south. Destroyed them. They went into bases. They dragged those soldiers out of their beds in their pajamas and their underwear. They destroyed the Israeli communication system in the south. So, the Israeli accounts we read is that they had no idea what was going on for hours. They had to watch Al Jazeera and go to WhatsApp and social media to find the Israeli army in Hakiria, as it's called, the Israeli command complex that is under Tel Aviv, that really exists under the civilian areas of Tel Aviv, unlike the fantasy ones that Israel's claimed are under hospitals in Gaza, that they were like looking at WhatsApp to find out what happened. This attack was a complete military defeat, strategic defeat, intelligence failure for Israel on a historic scale. And Israel has never recovered from that. This army never found its footing. It never achieved anything militarily. So the West and Israel see this defeat as one that they can't countenance, because if the Palestinians can get away with this, then, who else will try to fight us? Who else will challenge our supremacy? So they see the need to, quote, to restore their so-called deterrence, to make the Arabs scared again. Is that like an acronym there? Make Arabs scared again, Massa?
Oh, gosh.
Make Arabs scared again. They see that as essential to their survival in the region, that without fear and terror among the Arabs, Israel has no future there. And Israel hasn't been able to restore fear and terror among the Arabs. We see Lebanon is still fighting, albeit a very carefully calibrated escalation. But by the way, everything is relative, because people have been saying, it's a very low, relatively low intensity in Lebanon. It's only low intensity compared with Gaza. Mm-hmm. If everything else wasn't going on in Gaza, what would be happening now in Lebanon would be the main headline. It's over time, it's been pretty massive.
And in the north of this fake country called Israel.
Correct. Correct. And the same is true in the West Bank, by the way, where, again, that's been kind of overshadowed by what's happening in Gaza. But there, the escalation in the West Bank and the continued resistance in the West Bank would be seen to be at a historically high and significant level, but for the just overwhelming shadow of Gaza. And then, of course, Yemen, the resistance from Yemen and from Iraq potentially other places that shows that, Yemen hasn't been deterred by Israel or by the United States and Britain, and there's little they can do. So I think that the big picture is Israel remains defeated, and I don't see a time when it will become undefeated, because it's all cumulative. I mean, the present defeat, and again, we have to, people say, how can you say that Israel is defeated when they've killed tens of thousands of people? The French killed 1 million people in Algeria, and they were defeated. The Americans killed millions of people in Southeast Asia and Vietnam, and they were defeated. And hundreds of thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of people were killed in South Africa, either in fighting with the apartheid regime or violence that was directly linked to apartheid in terms of violence between freedom fighters and collaborators, or the wars in Namibia, Angola, and so on. And yet they were all defeated there too, the colonial powers. So what I want to say is you can't measure the defeat by how many civilians they kill. Because as I always say, if we're counting who can kill the most babies, Israel is the world champion, no doubt about that. But if you talk about this in terms of strategic achievements, Israel is defeated. And what I want to say, it's cumulative. This defeat follows other defeats, including, of course, the major defeat in Lebanon in 2006. So each one of these defeats has its cumulative effect, and people can start to see, well, Israel isn't this superpower, this mini superpower that we thought it was. It is a quite brittle, fragile, precarious settler colony that the moment it gets in real trouble, they have to empty the American stocks of weapons and the German stocks of weapons and send the aircraft carriers to try to save it. And I just don't think it has a long-term future.
Well, that is the pep talk we've all needed. I think that we all need to hear that and need to remember that, because you're right. Israel wins at killing babies, but in the long run, Zionism is not sustainable. I think this is actually an existential fight for the Israelis.
And that's not insignificant. We can't dismiss that, because you do have people who say, well, you know, I've seen people say, oh, well, you know, how could Hamas do this when they knew what Israel's response to would be? I mean, that's like saying to the Algerians, how dare they liberate themselves when they knew what the French response would be? Or how dare people in India fight for their independence from the British when they knew what the British response would be? And that's putting the blame on people who are fighting for their liberation, and not the blame where it belongs, on the barbaric colonial and imperial powers. That's where the blame belongs. And people shouldn't have to suffer the massacres and the horrors that all of these people around the world have had to endure for their liberation from this colonial savagery. But nobody's given them an alternative. Nobody in Palestine wants this. Nobody in Lebanon would want it. Iraqis didn't want it. Nobody wants it. But they're the ones who impose it. They're the ones who choose to murder babies in response to people saying, just let us be free. Let us live like normal people. And their response is, we're going to murder your children. We're going to murder your children for want. How dare you? We're going to murder your children for that. And Palestinians are the ones being blamed. I think that's what's monstrous to me.
Well, that's, you know, I think that's a good point to ask you about the fact that there was obviously this statement made by Fatah in recent days, essentially saying what you just said, which is to blame Hamas for bringing on a genocide. And a bunch of things happened in Lebanon that probably no one was paying attention to, because Lebanon is so insignificant except for Hezbollah. A lot of Lebanese have this attitude that they are the center of the universe, probably because they have a million media channels. But the only reason Lebanon's relevant or important in this region is because of Hezbollah's existence. And that's pretty much it. But there are, like, the sort of traitors came out of the out from under their rocks to, you know, make their statements of, oh yeah, we should just give the Israelis the South and be better than Hezbollah doing this. You know, you have that attitude that exists here as well. So every country has its traitors.
Yeah.
The Palestinians have the Palestinian Authority, which is an agent of the U.S. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it. But, you know, I think, Ali, the reason I raise this is because I think a lot of people, especially some younger people, are very new to learning about Palestine. They're horrified by what they're seeing. And, you know, like you said, the Israelis are still remain defeated. And so they have to bring out the traitors among the Palestinians to push the Israeli narrative. And so people probably who are new to this saw this statement and saw Palestinians on Twitter maybe fighting over it and Arabs fighting over it. So I'm curious if you could just kind of give a brief overview of the treachery among the Palestinians when it comes to the political leadership. Just so people have an idea of what they're dealing with when they hear the name Mahmoud Abbas or the Palestinian
Authority. Yeah, I mean, every liberation movement has had its class of traitors and collaborators, and every colonial power has fostered and nurtured a class of traitors and collaborators, and the Palestinians are no different. And sort of the main address for treachery and collaboration with the enemy is the Palestinian Authority. And in Lebanon, of course, you had the South Lebanon Army, which was a traitor militia led by Saad Haddad and then Antoine Lahd, which collaborated with the Israeli occupiers in the 1970s and the 80s and 90s. And of course, in France during World War II, there were many people who eagerly collaborated with the Nazis and sent Jews to their deaths. And that was true in the Netherlands and all the countries now of Europe. Did your power just go out?
It'll come back on. Lebanon, I'm in Lebanon, guys.
Right.
It's just normal. Give it three, two, one, and it'll pop back on.
Yeah.
I have a generator. Anyways, just good to keep going, Ali.
Yeah. So this of course is an old classic situation in a colonial struggle. And of course the argument always of the traitors is if we behave well, if we, you know, if we collaborate, if we eschew armed struggle, then the masters will treat us better. But of course, that's not true, because in the West Bank, where there is no significant Hamas military presence, there's a lot of political support for Hamas. They're by far, by any account, the most popular Palestinian political movement, whereas the Palestinian Authority and Fatah, the faction that dominates it, are broadly hated. The West Bank are the Israelis treating Palestinians in the West Bank better? Of course not. There are settler pogroms and land theft and daily killings of Palestinians, including children, with total impunity and support. And people understand too that if Israel gets away with the genocide in Gaza, if the resistance isn't able to draw a line in the sand for this savage enemy in Gaza, then they will turn. If they get away with the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, which I think still remains an Israeli goal, pushing the Palestinians there, at least those who they haven't murdered, pushing them into Egypt, they'll do the same in the West Bank, because the fanatics in this government are very clear that they view, you know, and in fact, it's Israel's constitutional law that was passed in 2018 that defines only the Jewish nation as having sovereignty and a right to all the land between the river and the sea, the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. So they are already accelerating in the West Bank. Just since October 7th, there's been a vast increase. I think the UN puts it at, it's now over 4,000 Palestinians ethnically cleansed from their homes and villages in the West Bank, which is a huge increase, because Israel has to do it sort of by salami slicing tactics in the West Bank, but they've been able to scale up. And if they get away with what they're doing in Gaza, they'll scale up even more. And we could see, you know, mass expulsions from the West Bank. Now, that gets back to something you alluded to earlier, where I have to say, you asked me, am I surprised about what Israel is doing? And I would say the answer to that is yes and no. I'm not surprised in the sense that I have always believed that Israel is truly genocidal and that there are no limits to what it would do to Palestinians if it could, whether expulsion or murder or other atrocities. There's no limit to what Israel wants to do. But I naively believed, I had this very naive belief that I think a lot of people did, that the so-called international community of the world would not allow it, that there would be some brakes put on Israel. And that was naive. We were wrong about that. There are no red lines. The West is unlimited in its support for Israeli barbarism, which I think only underlines to people in Palestine and across the region, is that you only have yourself and those who will support your resistance, and therefore resist the legitimacy and credibility and necessity of resistance becomes even more entrenched among people in the region.
It's actually similar to something Hassan Nasrallah said during one of his speeches. It was probably like the third or fourth speech that he gave after October 7th, but it was something along the lines of the world only respects those who are strong and have weapons and can defend themselves.
I think I know which speech you're referring to, and he actually made a very good point. Mm-hmm. He said that he actually addressed, I think it was one of his best speeches, actually. He addressed this sort of debate between those who, I think he called them those who favor surrender. It was a few weeks ago. But he talked about the surrender camp versus the resistance camp. And he said, you know, the surrender camp always point to the resistance and say, look at the cost of resistance. Look at, you know, all the tens of thousands of people killed and all the destruction and all of this. And he said, of course, you know, nobody wants that. But he said, look at the other side. Look at the cost of surrender. Mm-hmm. Talk about the cost of surrender. What has surrender cost our countries for decades? Not just in direct deaths and murder and invasions and occupations, which is a very real and tangible cost, but the fact that you don't control your own resources, your own destiny, your own land, your own future is also a terrible, terrible cost. And when I think about the cost that Palestinians have paid, it's not just in life and blood, which of course is already an intolerable and horrible cost, but the loss of lives lived, in the sense that people have spent decades in refugee camps while settlers from Europe or settlers from wherever it is have lived and farmed and lived these first world lives a few miles from the people whose land that is, who are caged in a ghetto in Gaza. What lives would those people have lived if they had been able to have their land, their resources, their livelihood? What would they have achieved? What would they have built? So that too is the cost of surrender if you accept it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That was a really powerful speech. Ali, I want to ask you about, well, I'm going to play Back to Brunch Karen for a moment. And I want you to respond to what, not me, Rania, but Back to Brunch Karen has to say about the upcoming presidential election this November. And that is that, look.
If you do the back to Brunch Karen voice, I maybe will be visited.
You might leave the stream.
No, I'm saying maybe we'll be visited by perhaps we will be visited by Dodi Benzona, our friend from the Israel Defense Forces, who will give an analysis of the terror that we are facing all over the region. And we are fighting the Hamas, the Hezbollah, the all of these terrorists across the region.
If anybody wants to catch Ali's excellent accent, oh my God, that's killed me so many times. You've done such a good job with that. You know what? Maybe Back to Brunch Karen should have a conversation with, what's his name?
Dodi Benzona.
Oh, wow. So Back to Brunch Karen. Back to Brunch Karen is someone who talks a little more like me, actually, but a little more annoying. And look, I get that you're like upset over Gaza and it kind of sucks. Mm. But if Trump was president, he would carpet bomb Gaza way more. And if Trump is president, he's going to put you and all your relatives like in concentration camps in the US. So you have to vote for Joe Biden because Trump is way worse. And do you care about fascism? Like, do you care about Black people? Do you even care about Muslim lives in America, Ali? Because if you vote or don't vote for Biden, like clearly you just don't and you're basically a white supremacist.
Mm. Yeah, we're already hearing that kind of thing. By the way, your Back to Brunch Karen is...
Thank you, but not as good as yours.
Well, and you know, but I mean, we're having a bit of a laugh, but like, honestly...
It's real.
This is the most laughing I've done in a while. You know, I mean, sometimes you just have to let the pressure out with laughter. And I think that's something I also learned from our friends in Gaza too. And so I don't want to think people think we're just making light of things. Humor has a role. That's something our dear friend Rifat al-Arir told us always. But we're already hearing this. And the way I think about it is, you know, my visceral reaction is not my problem. I don't care. You know, there's no way I would vote for I mean, to me, it boils down to, this is like saying, well, on the one hand, Hitler did the Holocaust, but on the other hand, he made the trains run on time. You know, don't you care about train schedules? Is people getting to work on time not important to you? What about that mother who needs to get to work on time? If her train is late, how should we do that? Like, you're asking me to weigh relatively trivial concerns against a genocide. And that asks me to accept that Palestinians are inferior to the lives of Americans. And I refuse to do that. Or Iraqis, because I remember in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was murdering, according to the UN, 5,000 children a month in Iraq, excess deaths due to disease and dehydration and lack of nutrition because of the sanctions on Iraq that the Clinton administration insisted on keeping and tightening. And of course, everyone remembers the famous, horrifying interview with Madeleine Albright, Clinton Secretary of State, who, when she was asked, you know, is the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children worth it, worth whatever the U.S. imperial goal was, she said, we think the price is worth it. She didn't deny it. She didn't say, no, those numbers aren't true. She said, we think it's worth it. And that was the, sorry, I'm getting a call. I shouldn't.
No, it's okay. You're a very important person.
I was on silent, but let me just, there are very few people who can, I have my phone on silent, very few people who are authorized to go through. So that's what it was. So I apologize for that. So, you know, it was always like, don't those Iraqi lives matter? Why do those Iraqi lives matter more than some American concern? And I get that in this system, those who pay the price first are people of color, are poor people, are marginalized people. But that is not the fault of Palestinians. That's the fault of this American political system. And it's the fault of this kind of lesser evil voting for decade after decade after decade, where the Democrats have never had any real pressure to change their ways because they take people for granted. And if you're telling me that, okay, now, even in a genocide, you have to vote blue no matter who, I mean, it's perverse, it's immoral. And it's also politically ineffective because it's brought us to literal genocide. And I think that the authors of this genocide, Joe Biden and his accomplices in the White House and the State Department, need to be punished. They need to be punished. They should pay a price. Of course, the correct price would be for them to be hauled before a criminal court or an international court and tried and convicted, because, you know, don't put me on the jury, but any fair jury would convict them, and spend the rest of their days in a cage. This is what they deserve at best. But that, you know, we should work for that. That should be a vision we have. But maybe the only means we have to punish them now is to make them lose, and they should lose. They should lose. And this bogeyman of Trump, I mean, yes, Trump is horrible for all the reasons we know, but using him as a bogeyman in this way, nobody should be scared for that. And it's largely Muslim American voters, not exclusively, who have been voting against Biden in these primaries as a protest. And many are saying that we won't vote for Biden no matter what. So they understand the potential cost of bringing Trump back to the White House. But they're saying, well, why should we be more important than people in Gaza? So I think there are political arguments and moral arguments to reject all that, plus the fact that it's just lies. The Democrats never fight for all these things they're claiming to do. They talk about it. I saw Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, put out a video the other day on Twitter where she's talking passionately about universal health care And I thought to myself, oh, when was the last time I heard any Democrat talk about universal health care? There must be an election coming up. And they do the same thing every time, where they, you know, in the months before the election, universal health care and immigration and refugees, et cetera, et cetera. Well, deportations haven't gone down during Biden's term of office. They're actually up from some numbers I saw from Trump's time. Where Biden has escalated wars all over the world. I mean, we've done whole programs on Ukraine. We don't need to go into that now. He has encouraged and supported this genocide, and that alone should be enough. If you're willing to say, you know, on the one hand, genocide, but on the other hand, Roe v. Wade. Well, they didn't even defend Roe v. Wade, the Democrats. They didn't even defend it. They didn't even fight for it. They didn't fight for it, let alone actually succeed in defending it. So I think we should ignore all of that. I'm not going to tell people what to do, but you should be willing to. You've just put Rifat on the screen, our dear friend who was murdered on December 6th by Joe Biden in Israel. The Democratic Party and Biden are responsible for the Gaza genocide perpetrated by Israel. Couldn't agree more. And they need to be punished. And stop rewarding them. Stop telling them, no matter what you do, we'll vote for you. Stop doing that. It's horrible. It's monstrous. Monstrous. We should reverse it. You know, what does Back to Brunch Karen say? She says, you don't care about, what is it, Muslims, or what are some of her arguments?
Black people, Latinos, immigrants.
Yeah, so you should say that you don't care about genocide. You're willing to live with genocide. You're willing to countenance and support genocide because of these parochial concerns you have. Just throw it back in their faces. It's disgusting.
It is. It is. And it's a conversation we end up having every 4 years anyway. I mean, I remember we had this conversation in 2016 when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were running against each other and she still managed to lose somehow. But every 4 years they put a gun to our heads. They say that the other side is the worst case scenario. And I heard you say it best, Ali. I can't remember in which interview, but I just recall you saying, genocide is the worst case scenario.
It's the worst case scenario. Would it be different with Trump? Probably not. He'd probably fully support this genocide too. But there's an element of Trump that's somewhat unpredictable. And you don't quite know what he'd do. But I wouldn't have any expectation he'd be better.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't either. I wouldn't either. But also, the reason I put up Rifat's tweet specifically is because Rifat always had a tweet for something. But also, you know, Ali, as we start to wrap here, I wanted to ask you. You mentioned, you know, December 6th was the day he was assassinated by the Israelis. Back in, you know, that was, it's been what, December, January, February. It's been 3 months, more than 3 months since Rifat El-Arir's death. Murder at the hands of the Israelis. He endured 3 months of genocide, 2 months of genocide. So I wanted to ask you, you know, this was a very close, dear friend of yours, a colleague of yours, who wrote a lot for the Electronic Intifada. And you were in touch with him, obviously, quite regularly after October 7th. As this genocide continues, you know, what are your thoughts 3 months on from his murder?
Rifat has, I miss him. I mean, that's the first thing. I miss him, and so many people do. He was a remarkable individual. He was a rare person who, you know, when you were talking to him, you felt like you were the only person in the world who mattered to him. And he had the ability to make hundreds or thousands of people feel that way, all his students in Gaza. And one of the hardest things for me is that, you know, many of our writers at the Electronic Intifada were Rifat students. And they say, you know, I miss him. He was always there to advise me about anything. I could text him and he always had time for me. And that includes during this genocide, where even as he was caring for dozens of his own family members, he also still kept caring for all his students and friends and people in Gaza and around the world who he cared about. And he never stopped working. I mean, working in the sense of wanting to get the message out. So he would be sending me by WhatsApp articles by students of his and saying, you know, so-and-so wrote this article, would you be able to publish it? He was helping them. He was editing. He was making suggestions. We used to joke that he was our Gaza bureau chief, but it was real. I mean, because he did so much to encourage and support people. So I miss him very much, and many, many, many people do. It's heartening to see that people still remember him. They're still inspired by him. And they continue his legacy. But I also feel anger and rage for those who murdered him and those who are complicit in his murder, who incited for his murder. And I think we have to remember, too, that Rifat was a special person dear to us. He was among many of Gaza's intelligentsia and intellectuals and teachers and educators who have been deliberately targeted and murdered by Israel in this genocide, along with the destruction of all the universities, leaving, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of students with no future prospects for education in Gaza, which is part of the genocidal goal. And just a few days before Israel murdered Rifat, they murdered the president of the Islamic University of Gaza, where Rifat taught. And they've murdered many senior academics, including many senior doctors, teachers in the medical schools, and so on in Gaza. So that's just to put in context his murder, which touched us particularly hard because of our personal connections. But Rifat would want us to remember him in the context of all of his colleagues in Gaza who have also been murdered. And there has to be justice. You know, now our focus has to be ending the genocide. But there has to be justice for Rifat and all these people. And one thing I want you to say, I want to respond to from earlier part of our discussion when we were talking about the need for a pep talk, and you were saying how people are going out and protesting, and but there's demoralization, that it's not having an impact. It is having an impact. It is absolutely having an impact. The politicians and the rulers in our countries, as uninterested as they are in representing people, they do feel it. And we can't let up on it, on the protest, on the disruption, on making noise in every place and in every time. And this is the one thing that our friends and colleagues in Gaza tell us, that don't forget about us. Don't be silent about what they're doing to us. Keep it up. And so to the extent that there is a shift happening and the pressure is increasing, and even the Biden administration is trying to, you know, we should not fall for any of their efforts to paint themselves as humanitarian. The fact that they feel a need to do so is because of the pressure, and we have to keep it up.
Yeah, they're building that pier, which is also like another military presence, but they also already have a bunch of other military presences. They do a lot of theatrics to try to prove their humanitarianism.
Yeah.
But you just reminded me, there is something that I do want to get your opinion on too. And that is, because you're talking about protest matters and everything we've been doing. It does matter, absolutely. And I think it trickles up sometimes. And I was really impressed to see the director of the film Zone of Interest, when he won his Oscar, use his acceptance speech to essentially compare Israel to Nazi Germany. And the Israel lobby went nuts. They lost their minds. They were like, how dare he? And of course, they were most offended because he put his Jewishness front and center to do that, to condemn the Israelis and make that very explicit comparison. I mean, it was still a bit too sidesy for me, but I think it was a pretty big deal that this man got up on stage and said what he said at the most watched, you know, Hollywood awards show in the world. And the reaction was just like, you know, sometimes it seems like the Zionists they've dehumanized anti-Zionist Jews almost as much as they have like any other enemy of Zionism, to the point where they want to kill them too. That's kind of like the, you get like a homicidal almost hatred that comes out for these people. And I think that that is an example of like everything people have been saying on the ground making its way into a big place. And I'm just curious your thoughts on that whole episode.
Yeah, I think there are these cultural moments that can happen, and we're seeing more and more of them. And of course, I think also of Aaron Bushnell, who made that just incredibly courageous and unbelievable sacrifice to draw attention to this genocide, and the profoundness of that act. And you know, nothing else can sort of match up to that, and people shouldn't have to do that. I mean, I think his message was to for people to do what they can do, you know. So the fact that I think it was Jonathan Glazer is his name, the director who made that statement, was welcome. I'm not going to say, like you say, I mean, maybe there were bits of it that I would have said differently, but you know, that's a legitimate difference you can have with it. But I think the reaction of the Israel lobby, the crazed reaction, is not going to help them, because I think what Jonathan Glazer was saying, and I haven't seen the film, but I've read sort of synopses of it, it applies directly to this situation. It's about the idea of, you know, just carrying on normal life in the shadow of unimaginable atrocities just over the fence or just close to you. And so what he did was to universalize the message of his film, which was a Holocaust film, and to say that, you know, essentially, if there's a lesson from something so horrifically atrocious as the Holocaust, it's that these lessons apply to all human beings. And that used to be what we were told was the so-called lesson of history from the Holocaust. But as people said, well, okay, then this applies to Palestinians too, the Israel lobby and the Zionists, who have hijacked the memory of the Jews murdered by the Europeans during World War II, have said, no, the message of the Holocaust is never again, but exclusively to Jews, and anything is permissible. Any atrocity is permissible in the name of protecting Jews. And by Jews, of course, they mean Israel, which is, in a sense, an anti-Semitic equation, because the safety of Jews all over the world is actually endangered by Israel and Zionism. So I just hope that, you know, probably the Oscars organizers and the Hollywood people thought, let's have this party where all this unpleasantness doesn't come in. And I think the message is, make sure that the unpleasantness comes in everywhere. Don't let any forum be undisrupted by the reality of this American-backed, American-armed genocide.
Absolutely. And lastly, Ali, while I have you on and I have the opportunity to ask you this, this is a bit of a tough question, because we're always talking about, you know, anti-imperialism and a multipolar world. And now that we're in this moment where we're watching a genocide unfold in Gaza, I do think it's really interesting that the actors that matter most are Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East. Groups like Hezbollah, the Iraqi resistance forces, and of course, Palestinian resistance front and center. But then you have these bigger countries like China, like Russia, and people are really frustrated, rightly so. With the Russian case, I mean, Russia still basically like kind of lets Israel bomb Syria, not kind of, lets Israel bomb Syria, doesn't do anything about it. And still has a relationship with the Israelis. It's a pretty close one. I mean, they say some things rhetorically that do matter, but ultimately internationally, they haven't really mattered in this. China, I mean, has made some good statements, though, like two statey statements that are a bit annoying, but they've made statements against Israel's behavior, against the atrocities, against the US's backing, but, you know, they've been pretty soft and they haven't like, you know, done anything, you know, much else than that. And it's been a bit disappointing. On the other hand, you could make the argument, and I've heard the argument, and it's a convincing one, that without China's economy, without China doing business with Iran, despite sanctions, you couldn't have a resistance axis in the Middle East. Mm. That makes sense too. That said, I'm just curious your thoughts on the role of China and Russia with regard to what's happening in Gaza right now.
I think there's truth to all of those positions you put forward. I think it's that Russia and China should be doing more. All countries should be doing more. If Nicaragua and South Africa are taking Israel to the International Court of Justice and taking Germany, in the case of Nicaragua, for supporting the Israeli genocide, then what excuse do Russia and China not have for not doing more? At the same time, China has stated openly that Palestinians have a right to armed resistance. That's a position that's sort of implicit. People say, okay, well, you know, it's there in international law, but very few governments actually come out and say it. Very few governments actually come out and say it. So that's somewhat significant. I think that the argument about, and I've heard this, I heard it put very eloquently recently by somebody, but I watch and listen to so many things. I can't remember who it was. So I'm not trying to deny them credit. I genuinely, you know, don't remember. But this argument that China hasn't in its own name been very active, but the fact that China is supporting the industrial base and the military development and production of Iran and other countries has a very significant material effect, because China could have taken the decision to go along with whatever sanctions and isolation of Iran and other countries, and they haven't done that at all. And the same is true to an extent with Russia, because some of the technology we're seeing, you know, there's an interchange in various kinds of military technology between Russia and Iran that does have a significant material impact on the ability and capabilities of the resistance. So that's important as well. And I think there's a third element to this, which is that where Russia and China are important because their relative, the growing relative power, especially China, to the United States diminishes the power of the United States. And when you diminish the power of the United States, you also diminish the power of Israel. So the extent to which the U.S. is no longer a unipolar global power is in and of itself beneficial, even if Russia and China aren't being as active as we'd like them to be. So I think there's truth to all those things. But I would say, yes, I think they should be more active, that said.
Everyone should be. I think that's a great way to put it. Ali, first of all, I want to thank you for joining me for an hour and a half to break all this down. It's always therapeutic hearing from you, and I always learn so much. And I really, more importantly, like want to, again, commend all of the incredible, tireless work that you and your colleagues have been doing at the Electronic Intifada. My whole family watches your live streams, reads all your articles. They're probably watching right now. So hello guys. They're huge fans.
Hello, Rania's family.
Hello. See, you got a personal hello, but no, I really, really genuinely want to thank you for everything that you and everybody at EI have been doing. And also please remind our viewers and listeners where they can follow your work if they're crazy enough to not already know.
Thank you. And likewise, you continue through Breakthrough News and your interviews to really bring some of the rare, you know, we need thoughtful, analytical discussion at this time. And you are one of the few places where we consistently get that. So I'm an avid and regular viewer of your show. I mean, what can I say? It's a mutual admiration society, but that's fine because it's great stuff that you're doing. You can find us at electronicintifada.net. You can find us on Twitter, and I think we're on, and of course on Instagram the Electronic Intifada, just at Intifada on Twitter. And we have our YouTube channel, Electronic Intifada, where we publish wonderful person, you know, one-on-one interviews, similar to what we're doing here, but my colleagues interview great people. And we have our live stream, which is typically once a week, typically on Wednesday, but it changes around sometimes. We will be having one today as we're recording. Actually, we're going out live today. I think it's Tuesday, March.
Oh, Ali, that is a long day for you. This and then that. Today's March
19th. Today's what? Today's Tuesday.
Tuesday, March 19th.
So tomorrow, Wednesday, March 20th, we have a live stream with Ilan Pape, the historian. Mm-hmm. And you can find all of that on our YouTube channel and do all the things, like, subscribe, so that you can know when we're doing it. And I'm very grateful to all my colleagues at the Electronic Intifada for all the work they do too.
Well, thank you again, Ali. And real quick, just a reminder to those who are watching, make sure you hit the like button. It helps us in the algorithm. I'm always yelling at the audience to do that. Ali and to the Electronic Intifada, thank you so much for joining me and for all your work again. Just incredible.
Thank you.
Hopefully we can do this again soon.